This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, a look at corporate responsibility on playing with food.
As we looked around, we realized that there weren't any real obvious charities that were supporting this community. So at that point in 2004, Janine and I established the Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers.
Also, two authors talk about their new books.
What I was shocked at is that we think anxiety is a psychological issue. It's just a sensation generated when you're in fight or flight. It's physiological.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 25th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with the local nonprofit organization, Slow for Home.
Hello, my name is Meher Ali, and I'm an intern with Issues and Ideas at KCBX Public Radio. I'm here today with my guest, Katie Lichtig, Vice President of the nonprofit Slow for Home. Katie, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
So let's start with how Slow for Home started. One of the things that I saw on your website was that it was to provide a safe haven for those who were fearing for their lives after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021. Could you talk about this and how Slow for Home came to be?
Absolutely. So our founders were watching the news and watching how so many people were being left behind who had helped the United States with our efforts to stabilize the government in Afghanistan. And they were very disappointed with the fact that we were leaving people behind. And so they committed themselves to creating an organization that could help those who were left behind in Afghanistan, and then created Slow for Home out of their efforts. We've been in existence for about 3 years, and we've brought 11 families and 35 people to the Central Coast. The ages range from 2 years old to in their mid-70s, and they're housed in San Maria to Paso Robles. So we've really increased our breadth and depth of refugees who we've brought, because we've expanded from Afghanistan to include Syria as well as the Ukraine, as the war in Ukraine has dragged on.
And the founders are Dr. Rogers and Lauren Brown.
One's a medical doctor and one's a PhD, and they're good friends. They go back a long way, diving buddies, as a matter of fact. And so that's how they got to know each other.
And were they at any point in Afghanistan? Is that how they kind of connect with this plight of Afghans, because you see things on TV, but not everything sticks. So is there like a personal connection?
There is not a direct personal connection to Afghanistan, but Vance was in the Navy and before he became a doctor, and Lauren was in the Peace Corps. So they come at it from different perspectives, but they both had those experiences of being part of an effort to uplift individuals who are in difficult situations.
And how about you? How did you come to be involved with Slow for Home?
Well, the interesting thing is that many of our volunteers have immigration stories of their own, and we've shared those among the board members. And mine is that my grandparents came from Eastern Europe and were being persecuted for being Jewish because of their religious practices. And I've heard stories about my grandmother and her family coming to Ellis Island and not being as warmly welcomed as we would hope. And so it really did mean a lot to me to help welcome people here in a warm embrace, as opposed to a little bit of a shove away from being part of our community.
Why did you decide to apply for Verdant Marketing's 24-hour gift rebranding competition? And what was that experience like?
Basically, it was a 24-hour effort in order to completely reimagine the brand of Slow for Home. So Verdin Marketing and its partners were willing to rebrand the winning nonprofit. And they've worked with a variety of nonprofits over the years. And basically what they include in the rebranding is a new logo, a new website, stationery, a presentation template, a social media strategy, a PR strategy, a public service announcement that we'll be using on TV, a variety of templates for letterhead and thank you notes, print ad. The first one is going to be in the New Times for Giving Tuesday, a media strategy, a web strategy, and key messaging. So those are all things that really well established nonprofit probably has, but because we're so new and because we've been working at it with all volunteers so far, this was an opportunity to uplift our organization so that we could continue to be sustainable, to really help the families even more than we've already been able to help.
And you mentioned the change in the name. It went from Slow Number 4 to Slow F-O-R.
Our name, which has changed, which I think is brilliant because we are really for the people who we're bringing here, for creating community, for creating families that feel uplifted and cared for.
Why is your nonprofit called Slow for Home?
Well, we wanted to send a variety of messages through our name, as well as now through our written material and our logo. We provide what I call wraparound services to the families who come here. So for those people, we provide for housing, we provide for transportation, we provide for social and community interactions. And so it's for our community that we're building not only their home, but our home too, that it creates a greater degree of diversity within our community and really embraces the newcomers to our community. And so that was really something that we wanted to convey, that we collaborate with our refugees in order to have them participate, because one of our goals is to help them become self-sustained in their new home on the Central Coast.
Can you actually talk to us about the refugee families that you have resettled? What country are they mainly from? Is it Afghanistan? What are their lives like here in the Central Coast?
I really appreciate that question because we started out with a focus of Afghanistan, but they're not all from Afghanistan. So we have four families from Afghanistan, three families from Syria, and then four from the Ukraine. So our families are working. They're members of the community. They are going to school, many of them. So both working and going to school for the adults. The kids are all enrolled in school or in preschool or in some sort of programs to help them. Many of them are learning English. Many of them are engaged with the volunteers that have helped them integrate into the community. They go to community events. They're so They're so grateful for the opportunity. They've all come from very dangerous situations where bombs are bursting near where they were living, on their way to school, on their way to work. And so to live in a safe place like the Central Coast has been a remarkable way to see them blossom and grow. And an example is that we have one of the refugees from Afghanistan who has started her own catering and cooking business, which is fantastic. Core Kitchen is the creation of Sophia. If you hear her talk about how women were treated in Afghanistan and how they're treated now, she would never have had this opportunity in Afghanistan. And her cuisine is absolutely amazing. And she's flourishing now. And that's true of her 5-year-old daughter, who's going to the Montessori school, which was a gift to Slow for Home when they first got here. And they're our first family that arrived. And so I would just say that they're all flourishing. As best as I can tell, they feel comfortable in their new environment. The weather is quite different for all of them, I would say. But I think that they've adapted to it really well. They're very flexible, very resilient, which is a testament to their ability to survive and to thrive here on the Central Coast.
And what would you say are like some of the main challenges that they face in rebuilding their lives here?
So finding housing that's affordable, which is true for everybody, right? It's not just a legal refugee issue. Finding work that is somewhat close to what they used to do. We have medical doctors, dentists who aren't able to practice their profession here anymore. And so finding good fits for them in terms of what they can get some job satisfaction from. I think finding new friendships and new connections in our community is something that we've focused on trying to make sure that we're sensitive to it. You know, our role is to welcome the refugees and help them make a home. And that includes friendships and connections in the community, whether it's within their own community, whether there's Afghani or Ukrainian or Syrian members of our community, or based on their religious beliefs. So we're really trying to help them make those connections.
If you're just joining us, my name is Meher Ali, and I am interning with Issues and Ideas at KCBX Public Radio. I'm here today with my guest, Katie Lichtig, Vice President of the nonprofit Slow for Home. Can you give an example of how you've done that to kind of connect them with the larger community, either in Slow or in the Central Coast?
So part of that comes from, we have a volunteer group called our Cultural and Hospitality Committee. And we want to make sure that they are getting opportunities to go out and meet people. So our advocates is what we call them. There's a single point of contact for the family when they come to the United States. And that person helps them connect with going to the beach, going to the PAC at Cal Poly, going to city activities like farmers market, or going trick-or-treating. Those advocates are out there trying to help the refugees make those connections either to the broader community or within their community. So we've had a number of advocates that have connected Ukrainian refugees with Ukrainian refugees so that they can help uplift each other. So it's really quite amazing to see how not only the volunteers are supporting the newcomers, but also our refugees from within our Slow for Home family have helped our other refugees uplift.
That's really incredible and really like uplifting to hear that.
Thank you.
Could you explain the process of how refugees are admitted and resettled in the U.S.?
So I'm not an expert on that topic, but I can tell you what I know. Those programs are administered by the State Department, and we connect with the refugees through an organization called Church World Services. It's a non-sectarian organization that has been resettling refugees since World War II and have been in this space of helping refugees resettle in the United States. We get connected with the different programs that are established, and they are different for Afghanistan, Syria, and Ukraine. So we get connected with Church World Services, who have interfaced with the State Department and ensured that the refugees have gone through all of the steps. There's a very long vetting process that refugees have to go through that include background checks and security checks and health checks. The programs definitely give the refugees different status when they come to the United States. Some come through by getting asylum. Some come through by a program that's called humanitarian parole. And some come through an extended process that the Syrians had to go through. So they waited in Syria, I believe, for 5 to 7 years before they were able to make this trip to the United States. It could be even longer than that. I might not remember that number correctly, but it was multiple years before they were permitted to come to the United States.
Do you foresee any more challenges as Donald Trump becomes president?
We're watching what's happening with the potential changes in programs. There has been a lot of rhetoric about what might change, but we can't rely on the rhetoric. We have to know what the facts are. So we're attending webinars with our partner at CWS. We're attending other types of refugee resettlement agencies, are putting on other programs. And we are a very small refugee resettlement organization compared to the ones in larger cities. And so we really have to keep a finger on the pulse of what's happening. And so we're tapping into those other resources. We're concerned about what might happen, but we're preparing to help our refugees navigate that no matter what it brings. And so we want to bring more refugees, and we want to support the refugees that we have here as best as we can. Like I said, we are an organization that provides wraparound services, and it's not just for a limited amount of time. They're part of our family now. They're part of our community. And so we're committed to making sure that we're informed about what the changes might bring to our refugee families, and then trying to figure out how we navigate with that. The numbers of refugees that were admitted to the United States during the first Trump administration were significantly reduced. And so the question will be, will we be able to welcome more families, or will we need to just focus on the families that we have here? But we're willing to take more. We want to take more. Some of our fundraising limits the numbers that we can welcome to our community, but I would say that also the laws may change, and so that might limit who we can help as well.
So what is next for Slow for Home after you have won?
So we need to implement all the great resources that we were given. So we've got public service announcements that you'll be seeing on one of the local TV station, KSBY. You'll see some radio PSAs. We also have a need for volunteers with specific skills. And so you'll probably see some asks for volunteers who have communication skills. They can help us with our website. They can help us with our social media strategy. They can help us implement other strategies that the 24-hour give awarded to us. And so our goal is to be able to, one, implement all the great resources that we were given, and to welcome new families going forward. And that means we're going to have to raise money. And so you'll see us out there in the ether to solicit volunteers and to raise money. I do want to say that if you look at how much volunteerism that we have been able to garner, because we have a great mission and our refugees are warmly welcomed here, we've received about 24,000 hours of volunteer services over this current year. And that doesn't include what we have going on for the rest of the year. So we're very grateful to our volunteers that have really welcomed the opportunity to give in the way that is in addition to money, but it's also in terms of their knowledge and skills and abilities to help these families be welcomed to the Central Coast.
And that's another topic that I would love to talk to you more about, how to harness volunteers and their skills. But that's for another time. Is there anything else you would like to add before we conclude?
Well, I'd like to thank you for this gracious opportunity to be able to share what Verdin Marketing and their partners has done for Slow for Home. It is a game changer for us. We hope to be here for many decades into the future. Feel free to look at our new homepage. Our new website is slowforhome.org.
Thank you, Katie, so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Meher Ali, an intern with Issues and Ideas at KCBX Public Radio. I was just speaking to my guest, Katie Lichtig, Vice President of the nonprofit Slow for Home.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Playing with Food.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. What does corporate social responsibility have to do with food, and what does food have to do with corporate social responsibility, or CSR? CSR is a business model in which social and environmental issues are integrated into business operations with buy-in from the stakeholders. This is considerably different than a business model that focuses solely on profits. It has to do with food when a prominent farmer and wine producer in the region operates his business on this model, which is having a positive impact on our community. So I invited myself to Brian Talley's house for dinner and a chat, and this is how it went.
Hi, I'm Brian Talley. I'm a third-generation farmer and a second-generation wine grower. So what are we doing here today?
We are making a farm-to-table dinner inspired by things that we grow at Tally Farms, as well as wines that we make at Tally Vineyards.
Okay, great. But I'm also here to talk to you about some of the corporate social responsibility that you do. That kind of stuff is in the farm and the winery?
Yes, indeed. The winery is SIP certified. That's an acronym for Sustainability in Practice. And it's a certification program where we're audited annually for our sustainability practices. And that includes the materials that we apply in the vineyard. It also includes the fact that we provide health insurance for all of our employees, and the fact that our winery is 80% solar powered, and the fact that we recycle all of our wastewater.
Let's go back a little bit to the farming. What kind of things do you grow?
We grow about 30 different kinds of vegetables. We operate a very successful CSA, so that's community supported agriculture, referred to as the Tally boxes. And then on the vineyard side, we farm 6 different grape varieties that we shape into about a dozen different wines.
Well, let's get started on the meal.
Sure.
Okay.
The first thing I'm going to do is unbox our Tally box. These are some beautiful sweet orange peppers that we're going to include in our meal tonight. This is some spinach that is gonna be included in this beautiful orzo salad that Janine is making for dinner tonight. We've got some cilantro, which is one of our signature vegetable crops. We're one of the bigger growers of cilantro in the state of California.
I did not know that.
We have got some corn. This corn, I think people kind of take corn for granted until they taste ours. And we've got some green beans. And this was how I got my start at Tally Farms, was picking beans when I was 12 years old. That is what is in this week's Tally box.
Okay.
At least the Tally's Tally box. The first thing we are going to make is some guacamole. One of my favorite things is guacamole and Chardonnay. And those are two things that grow together right here on our farm in the Arroyo Grande Valley. We're going to make some guacamole, then we're going to open some Chardonnay, and we're going to have those two things together. These are Tally Farms avocados, and I harvested these myself over the past couple of weeks. They have higher oil content. They tend to be really unblemished in terms of the flesh inside.
I first met you and Janine through the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. There was a presentation of older teenagers who were DACA students. And this was right after the last administration where they had ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, cracking down on undocumented workers.
Right.
That was the beginning of me hearing once every year or so, oh, well, at Tally Farms, they do this for their employees. Like you said, you give healthcare to your field workers. What other things do you do specifically for your employees that some other farmers wouldn't be doing?
In my experience, more and more farmers are doing this. I think more people are buying in to the fact that the better we treat our employees, the more likely it is that we will attract better employees. Labor has been in a shortage for several years. That's starting to ease up, but you know, there's a lot of competition for good people. So some of the examples of things that we do, offering health insurance to all of our employees. Increasingly, our employee base are folks that are here from Mexico on the H-2A visa program. And so part of that program mandates that we provide housing for them, which we do. We also provide housing for many of what we call our domestic employees, who are folks that live here year round. So we have a number of those people that live on our property. We have a scholarship program, which employees at both Tally Farms and Tally Vineyards are eligible for.
Is that the money that comes from the sale of one of the wines?
There's a separate scholarship for the Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers, but the scholarship that I was talking about is one that just folks from Tally Farms and Tally Vineyards are eligible for. The Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers, that supports the farm worker community throughout San Luis Obispo County. Yeah, the majority of the money that we raise for that program has come in the past from the sales of Mano Tinta. The Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers, the goal was to get that up to an endowment of $1 million. And so what that means is that this year we'll make grants of more than $30,000 to support farm workers in San Luis Obispo County.
And is that something that's common?
No. And that was really inspired by my relationship with Archie McLaren, who had established the Central Coast Wine Classic as a fundraiser for KCBX. He had established a bigger charitable initiative where he was giving money away to worthy charities. And he asked me one time if I had any ideas about what we might do. And I said, well, I think we should support the farm worker community. And this was modeled in the Napa Valley, where they have raised over the years millions of dollars to support farm workers in the Napa Valley. Archie agreed that that was a good idea. As we looked around, we realized that there weren't any real obvious charities that were supporting this community. So at that point in 2004, Janine and I established the Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers. The idea was that we would reach out to the local industry, have other people chip in with charity wines, as well as the Central Coast Wine Classic, which really kind of gave us the seed money to kick the thing off by including that as what they call a fund a need lot. Essentially, people just raise their paddle to make a donation to something that they consider to be a worthy cause. Things kind of came full circle in the very last year of the Central Coast Wine Classic. The Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers was the beneficiary of that particular auction lot. I think we raised more than $60,000 just within about 15 minutes.
That's great. I don't want to pull you away from the guacamole, we're never going to eat.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, learning about CSR, or corporate social responsibility, at Talley Farms and Talley Vineyards in Arroyo Grande. Third-generation farmer Brian Talley is whipping up a traditional Santa Maria-style barbecue with his own fresh produce as we dive into corporate social responsibility and sip wines from his vineyard. We just started with some guacamole.
So that was quick.
Let's start with the maiden voyage of guacamole tasting. Janine's having the first taste, and we're getting some 2022 Talley Vineyards Estate Chardonnay open right now. It's going to be perfect with this.
Excellent.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. It's very nice. Very creamy avocado. And the wine does go well. What grows together goes together. Is that what you said?
Yep.
So tell me about this Pride wine.
Pride is a skin contact blend of Chardonnay and Gruner Veltliner that we made to benefit the LGBTQ community in San Luis Obispo. The profit that we generate from the sales of the wine benefit the Gala Pride and Diversity Center.
Well, you don't have to do this. You're not a member of the LGBT community. This is something that you don't have to do. Like, so why?
We had an experience a little over a year ago where we got educated about some of the issues and challenges facing that community. I'm proud of the fact that we have a very diverse workforce at both Talley Farms and Talley Vineyards, including members of the LGBTQ community. After learning what I did, I realized that there was an opportunity for us to step up and provide some support. When we get done with this little initiative, we will have made a contribution of about $20,000 to the Gala Center in San Luis Obispo. And I think that demonstrates our commitment to supporting folks in our community that benefit from that support.
Then it was on to some sides. The first made by Brian's wife, Janine, and then Brian and I go outside.
So what are we doing here?
Orzo salad with spinach, peppers, Kalamata olives, green onions, pine nuts, and feta cheese. And it's really, really good.
And this is our side dish for today?
Yes.
Okay, fabulous.
I am just shucking a little bit of Talley Farms corn, which I'm going to throw on the grill. All right, I'm getting ready to put our tri-tip on.
Oh, you got a lot of stuff out here.
Yeah, so we've got some peppers, the makings for garlic bread.
A little bird told me that you have a cookbook.
Yes, I do. The profit that we generate from the sales of that cookbook benefit the Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers.
So more corporate social responsibility, even with your cookbook.
Right.
Your very glamorous, very colorful, lots of pictures cookbook.
I decided when I was in college that I wanted to write a book. And once I figured out I could write a book that was mostly pictures, which is a cookbook, I was all in. Wrote that in 2016. Really just kind of a fun collection of things that I had developed over the years. I've been in love with cooking really since I was a kid. Collected recipes from family and friends, and really a wonderful way to preserve some family history,
tell our story in Tally Farms and Tally Vineyards, talk about how food and wine pair very nicely together. One of my favorite recipes in there is my grandmother's apple pie recipe, which is a very simple recipe. And I actually have the notebook from the day that I spent an afternoon with her teaching me the recipe, and I wrote it in my cooking journal. That's something that I still have to this day. Other things were recipes that I developed while I was writing the cookbook. We had a chance to go to Mexico City, and there were several things, including some chiles rellenos that I fell in love with, stuffed with corn and squash blossoms, that were an inspiration for the book. Actually, the first recipe that I wrote for the book was Santa Maria style barbecue, because it was something that I've done a lot over the years. And I figured, okay, this is a way to see what it's like to write a recipe. I was blessed with a person who had published a number of cookbooks, more than a dozen cookbooks at that point. He had come from the magazine industry, so he worked with a book designer, professional editor. It was nice to have a team of professionals to really support me in the endeavor. The orzo salad that Janine has prepared is in the cookbook. The guacamole that we started with is in the cookbook. The pinquito beans that we'll have are in there.
I understand that there's a little bit of differences in the family with regard to the avocado ice cream.
Yeah, that is the most controversial recipe in the cookbook. That was another recipe that was inspired by that trip to Mexico City. Yeah, we got to have a fabulous avocado ice cream. It was stunning, and it was like, okay, I want to do that too. Both my mother and Janine feel that there's better uses for avocados than avocado ice cream.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, learning about CSR, or corporate social responsibility, at Tally Farms and Tally Vineyards in Arroyo Grande. While the vegetables and tri-tip cook on the barbecue, a visit to the wine cellar is a must.
This is my wine cellar. One of my favorite things about being a wine grower and a wine lover is having a wine cellar at my house. I am thinking that we should have some Tally Vineyards Pinot Noir with this lovely Santa Maria style barbecue that we're going to have. And we may as well go. This is some five-year-old Pinot Noir from Rosemary's Vineyard. Rosemary's my mother. This vineyard surrounds her house. This should be stunning with our barbecue tonight.
Fantastic.
You are the only other person I know, other than me, who does their corn naked on the barbecue.
Oh, okay.
Everyone's like, you have to do it in the husk, or you have to wrap it in aluminum foil. And I'm like, no.
Why?
So, speaking of a farmer who likes to cook, when did you start cooking?
My mother taught me how to make these little muffins. They're called French breakfast puffs. They're just a very simple muffin that you dip in butter and then a combination of sugar and cinnamon. Who wouldn't like that? So those were tasty. I was probably 8 or 10 when I started doing that. That was one of the first things that we taught our girls how to cook. Both my dad and my grandfather are very accomplished barbecuers, so I had a lot of exposure to this. And then as I got into the wine industry, late 80s, early 90s, I just realized the whole interaction between food and wine and how important that was, and just really started to embrace it. One, as a way to show off my wines and entertain people. And even in high school, I was the guy that, you know, wanted to run the barbecue and hang out with my friends and be the host. So I've continued that to this day. All right, so we've got our pinquito beans, garlic bread, corn, cooked the way that you and I like it, which is just husked corn right on the grill. We've got our tri-tip here, and then we've got our beautiful orzo salad. And then over at the table, we've got some grilled red and orange peppers and a bottle of 2019 Rosemary's Vineyard Pinot Noir.
Fantastic.
Bon appetit.
Bon appetit. You do all of these things with, you know, you provide healthcare to your field workers, which not everyone does. You've got these scholarships for your employees and for farm worker children. You're doing wine for the LGBTQ community. You're doing a cookbook for the scholarship.
For the Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers.
Right. What are you learning from this? What are you learning about yourself? What are you learning about your employees? And what are you learning about, I suppose, the human condition?
I don't know that I'm learning this, but it reinforces the fact that I love our community. Born and raised in Arroyo Grande. I went away to college up in Berkeley for 5 years, came back here. I'm just blessed that my line of work affords me the opportunity to continue to support
our community. And I'm blessed that Janine and I met each other back in the late 80s, got married in 1995. She got involved with the Community Foundation at the inception of the Community Foundation, and we just celebrated the 25th anniversary of once the need was identified to support the farm worker community. It was just this amazing nexus of something that was very interesting to her that I wanted to support that could support the people that really make our business possible.
Do you have a different understanding of the farm worker community than you did when you were growing up and learning the business from your grandfather and your father?
I think it's evolved. A number of things have changed in this community and in California's economy over the last 40 years since I've been doing this. Somehow we're trying to strike this balance between being profitable, but also paying our people enough so that they can afford to live in one of the most expensive places to live in the world, quite frankly. It's a lot of other folks want to live here and there's not enough housing. Yet it's also one of the best places in the world to grow all of these beautiful vegetables and the wine grapes that we do. That's what I've learned and has become increasingly apparent over the last, 10 years, I think, especially.
The corn is like sugar. Amazing.
Yep.
What does, if anything, corporate responsibility have to do with food and food have to do with corporate responsibility?
Agriculture is responsible for the creation of civilization. One of the most powerful experiences that Janine and I have gotten to have is with a young lady who is a recipient of the scholarship that we grant through the Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers. She's actually at my alma mater at UC Berkeley. The Community Foundation Scholarship Committee chooses the scholars. And we realized after that choice was made that she was actually the daughter of one of our employees. We have had, a number of engagements with her. First of all, her father is a wonderful guy who is a truck driver in our Tally Farms Fresh Harvest program or the Tally Box program. She's just a delightful young lady at UC Berkeley who is probably going to become a teacher. She's just so humble and grateful for the support that she has received from the Fund for Vineyard and Farm Workers, but even more significantly from her family, who has really done all the right things to put her in a position to be really successful going forward. And that's inspiring to me to see these second and third generation young people who are going to go out and do something exciting with their lives. And that's really what I think our country is all about.
How has your awareness for how you treat your employees and how you engage as a part of the wider community, where does that come from?
I think that that was certainly something that was modeled, especially by my father. My dad was more of a person who really befriended our employees, went down to Mexico with them and learned about their hometowns and their culture. And I think they had a lot of respect for that. I think it was mutual respect. Those were the kinds of things that were modeled for me.
So are we going to finish with avocado ice cream?
No, we are going to, if you want something a little sweet, we will finish with some lemon meringue pie, which is also in the cookbook. Do you want some lemon meringue pie?
Sure.
Okay.
This is a Meyer lemon meringue pie.
Yes, it is.
It's in the cookbook.
Yes.
And you made it yourself.
I did.
Okay, here we go. Yeah. I like it.
Thank you.
Tally Farms and Tally Vineyards are two examples that not all corporations are bad. Taking care of employees and the community actually lead to a happier, healthier, and more sustainable company and community. And it's fantastic to have in our community people who share the sentiment of Brian's last words.
We have been able to align around the idea that we want to produce quality products. We want to treat people with respect.
Shouldn't that be what everybody wants? This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman.
Hello, I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Dr. David Hanscom, author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain, and Dr. Doug Garland, author of The Tall Poppy Syndrome, The Joy of Cutting Others Down. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Now, a listener might wonder, what are we doing talking to two doctors about pain and tall poppy, which is a sociological issue? And believe me, I promise we're going to weave those two things together, and we're going to have a great time doing it. David, let's start with you. As author of a Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain, you were a major spine surgeon, and you did that for years. How did your career and your personal background lead you to write this book?
Well, I went to a very high-level spine fellowship, and I came to Seattle, Washington in 1985 on fire to do spine surgery. I was a very aggressive spine surgeon, and it took me about 7 years to realize that the surgeries were not working very well. And so the data came out in 1993 that the success rate of a spine fusion for back pain was about 22%.
Wow.
And I just stopped. At the same time, I went into severe chronic pain myself with 17 different physical and mental symptoms, and I almost didn't make it through. I was suicidal. I had every symptom you can imagine. And so I went on this quest in 1990 to find out what happened. How did I go from being a fearless spine surgeon to being so sick in one day? So I would say today represents the end, but a very significant step in the quest of a 35-year quest to find out how could I go from being a fearless spine surgeon to crippling anxiety, severe depression, OCD, migraines, burning sensation, stomach pain, back pain in one day.
That's unbelievable. In other words, in a way, being at the top of your profession, being in the healing profession, to me, all the societal indicators would be that you were a complete and utter success.
That's the problem, because I had all the success and I was as miserable as you could get. So I call it the anxiety with success. I mean, you've done everything right. You're still miserable. What do you do next?
You wrote a book.
Well,
not right away.
I learned basically this whole thing the hard way. I started working backwards. I came out of it somewhat by accident in 2003, and I started looking more seriously at the science. And in 2020, I met a group of scientists who actually looked at the autonomic nervous system that regulates your fight or flight response. And when you're under sustained stress, your body breaks down. But what I was shocked at is that we think anxiety is a psychological issue, correct? It's just a sensation generated when you're in fight or flight. It's just a description of a sensation. It's not psychological. It's physiological.
I think that's a fundamental point. And just to clarify, help us understand, there are generally three ways pain can be generated.
Well, right. People think there always has to be a source of pain. So first of all, the mental pain is the biggest problem.
Uh-huh.
So we have a model called dynamic healing, where you have your adversities and stresses and threats to life. We call that the input. Then your nervous system, through all these sensors, processes the input and sends out signals that determines your physiology of either being fight or flight or safety. So what happens is that thoughts are also sensory input that are perceived as physical pain. With physical pain, we have an automatic withdrawal response called nociceptive system. With mental pain, there's no protection. So it turns out that the mental pain is the bigger problem, but it's processed in the same way as physical pain. You can't tell the difference.
So if you get injured, and I think in the book you talk about accidentally putting your hand or a finger on a hot stove, you're going to withdraw. I mean, there's pains involved, of course, but you're instantly going to withdraw your hand or your finger from the source of the pain. Or an illness, you're going to be treated with antibiotics or whatever it might be. But with mental pain, it doesn't get treated.
Well, So the problem with mental pain is simply reflecting your stress chemistry, your stress physiology. So in the dynamic healing model, you have your person who's under stress or not. So in modern medicine, we don't know our patients. We don't have a chance to talk to them. So we don't know what their stresses are. Then we don't know their coping skills. Few of us have been taught how to process adversity efficiently and effectively. So when your stresses overwhelm your coping skills, you go into fight or flight. Then you get symptoms. So the symptoms are a result of this interaction. So in medicine, we're treating just the symptoms. where the reality is we have to know you as a patient. We have to understand your background of who you are, how you cope. We need to teach you how to adjust your physiology. Then the symptoms resolve. All 17 of my symptoms are gone. I had them for over 25 years. I was about as miserable as a human being as you can ever imagine.
It took you many years to recover?
It did, but I didn't know the answer. So when people understand the concepts, usually within 3 to 6 months, there's a pretty profound change. People quit coming out of fight or flight. The body regenerates and rebuilds. We call it deep healing, where your body has more safety physiology, less threat, and your body refuels, regenerates. And when people heal, it's not just fixing or managing the pain, mental or physical. The body regenerates. I mean, the changes are spectacular. I would say miraculous. But life is a miracle. Healing's a miracle. So as you get the body to heal, the results are unbelievable.
It's surprising to me. I mean, a lot of this makes sense to me, intuitive sense, but it's surprising to me that this phenomenon, this problem, and its solution hasn't been recognized more readily or more broadly by the medical profession. And we had been talking earlier that, you know, is this a problem of the insurance companies being greedy or doctors being, you know, callous or greedy? What's your opinion about that?
Well, I'd like to ask Doug his opinion, because I have not only is medicine not adopting this, they're fighting it like crazy. So I have been beat up so many different times. One person turned me into the state from being mentally unstable. I tried to get fired by my hospital 3 times. When I quit my job, I had 3 administrators, unbeknownst to them, talk to a friend of mine that did not know was a friend of mine, how happy they were that David Hanskin retired. So the body heals so well. As you help people calm down and redirect the nervous system, the symptoms disappear. So I was watching hundreds and hundreds of patients go to pain-free, mentally and physically. I was operating on less, even people with surgical lesions were going to pain-free. And all I was doing is following the data. The data says help people sleep, help them calm down, adjust medications, do some exercise, all these things you're supposed to do before surgery. We call it prehab or rehab before surgery. So I had over 120 patients with spinal stenosis, pinched nerve, surgical problems. We did 12 weeks of rehab before surgery on every patient every time. So 2/3 of my patients got better. So from a financial standpoint, it was very awkward for me. And 1/3 of the patients that I did surgery on did beautifully. But at the end of the day, I was operating on less than 5% of my patients. Most surgical practice is about, what, 15 to 20%, Doug? That they operate on them?
Yes.
The only reason I made a living, because I was on call, is operating on people with IV drug addiction problems that had infected spines. It's a sad way to make a living. But my elective practice was delightful. People were getting better. And it wasn't having them live with the pain. The pain would actually disappear.
I'd like to remind everyone, I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Dr. David Hanskin, author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain, and Dr. Doug Garland, The Tall Poppy Syndrome, The Joy of Cutting Others Down. Doug, you and I have talked before. We've been interviewed here on this radio station. And one of the fascinating things to me about the tall poppy syndrome is that it is ancient, going back to biblical times or before even. But it is largely unknown, known more in some countries like Australia than others. You yourself, perhaps analogous circumstances to David, you were tall poppy towards the end of your career. Can you tell us about that?
I was in Southern California running a spinal cord injury unit service. At that time, I was president of the American Spinal Injury Association. I'd been at that hospital about 25 years, published a fair amount of scientific work, and I came back to our institution after an international spine meeting. And my premier office had been moved down to a cubbyhole in the hospital. So I went home and told my wife what happened, and she said, they've moved your cheese, which was a popular book at that time about change in life. And she convinced me to resign my post. So the next day, I went in, threw away all my research, all my slides, presentations, all the programs we had put on at the hospital under my supervision, put the key on the desk and walked out. And fortunately, my wife had good emotional intelligence. Otherwise, I would have become angry. I would have sought revenge. I would have tried to seek out who made that decision. And even if I won, I would have not won, because every time I came back to the hospital, I would harbor ill feelings towards people.
Right.
So thanks to my wife, I made the right decision. But be that as it may, some people didn't like it that I was appeared to be better than others because I had a lot of academic stature, and they cut me down.
What's the historical background to the tall poppy syndrome? It's the Middle East, the historical, like a king and his son.
Well, originally it was described in ancient Greece, which was a little before the kingdom of Rome. So Herodotus described it initially, and it was one city-state governing another city-state. One was doing very well, and the other one wasn't doing so well. So they sent a messenger from the state that wasn't doing well to the head of the state that was doing well. And he sent the messenger, went to a poppy field, and he leveled all the poppies. And the message was that if you want to rule a state, you have to cut down all the people in opposition, which were tall poppies, in order to govern. And so the kingdom, there were seven kings in Rome before it became a democracy. And the last kingdom, the same situation happened. His son was governing one of the outlying posts, wasn't doing well, and sent a messenger back to his father. He did the same thing. He cut down poppies. So his son knew what to do, but unfortunately it backfired because his son cut down some important people, and they revolted, and that led to the downfall of the kingdoms, and the Republic of Rome started.
You know, if you go back, come forward into modern history, I'm looking at Stalinist Russia, and I'm sure you know where I'm going with this, that the first thing after the Russian Civil War was done in the 20s, Stalin started thinking about going after his colleagues in the Bolshevik Party, so-called old Bolsheviks. And once he, in the early 30s with the show trials, had imprisoned or killed most of them, he went after his generals to reduce dissent, I suppose, or promote loyalty. But they were very poorly prepared for the German invasion because Stalin had tall poppied pretty much everybody in the Russian intelligentsia.
Well, Genghis Khan did the same thing. I mean, all the rulers, they all participated in that same concept, kept down the opposition. Genghis Khan, every time he conquered a new village, cut down everybody that was taller than the axle, meaning that all that were left were young, formative minds.
Wow.
So that anybody that had any smarts or potential opposition would be cut down. So that was our early society. Wherever part of the world you were in, and it's become more civil, but conceptually, it's remained the same.
David, what do you think are the psychological underpinnings of how people deal with pain? Is it misunderstanding? Is it physiological tendencies? Like, I joked earlier that if, as human beings, when we're faced with something new or different, fight or flight, if those are our only two options, then hugging or even greeting the person with an open hand, showing we don't have a weapon, that's not there. It's just that either or, on or off, fight or flight, and compromise and making friends doesn't seem to be part of the picture. What do you think about that? Is there sort of an anthropological reason for this?
Yeah, definitely. And that's where I think medicine has missed this, where so every living creature wants to feel safe. Like, for instance, whales sleep with one eye open, giraffes stand on their feet to sleep. And everybody, so the wild kingdom is always on high alert, including humans, for physical safety. So with humans, we have the neocortex or thinking brain, which actually also is processed in a similar manner as physical pain. And so we're always seeking safety there. So there's no rewards in the wild for being physically vulnerable. You die. In the human experience, as far as emotional pain, there's actually no rewards for that either. So it hurts. When you say you hurt my feelings, it's the real deal. Yet, so people don't want to be vulnerable because you can get hurt. But yet being vulnerable is the essence of successful human relationships. So what we use instead of – so one of the antidotes to anxiety, or I'm going to say threat physiology – remember, anxiety is just the word we use for fight or flight. So the antidote for that is control, and the more control you have, the better. Your body is – your body's physiology goes through the roof when you've lost control, and you have better physiology when you're in control. So that's where the tall poppy thing comes into place, is that people feel better if they cut somebody else down. They feel like they have control. They also do it to themselves with a self-inflicted negative voice. So there's this endless battle in our own brains about good, bad, adequate, not adequate. And so we're in this constant fight or flight state where we break down pretty badly.
There's a concept that we really have two brains, as in Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And the slow part of our thinking is more deliberative, more rational. And the fast is more – well, it's quicker and more visceral, more emotional based. And it seems as though all too often the fast pathway of thinking about things and prioritizing action – is the fast one and not the slow one. We don't take the time, that's my own opinion, to think about it. I mean, I've heard a definition of a spiritual person is a person where if they're going to say or do something that might be hurtful to others, they put distance between that thought or that deed and the actual action, and they decide perhaps to soften it or not say the cutting comment altogether. But if we're hasty, if we're in a hurry, we say things and do things, especially now on the internet, that we regret. And it's that the fast part of our brain processes and reacts a lot more quickly than the rational side.
Right. The unconscious brain processes between 20 to 40 million bits of information per second. 20 to 40 million. The conscious brain processes about 40. So this unconscious quick reaction is automatic. It's hardwired. A friend of mine, Bruce Lipton, has pointed out that anger and anxiety are automatic, hardwired reactions that we have no control over. So to get to the other problem is when you're in that reaction, the blood supply to your thinking brain or neocortex gets downregulated, so you actually can't access reason when you're triggered and upset. And then when you can't escape adversity, i.e. your thoughts being one of them, and you feel trapped, then we're in fight or flight, we're not thinking. If you notice, humans are a very reactive, angry species because we're trapped. Look at us compared to other mammals. We're angry a good share of the time. And when you're angry, you're not thinking clearly, and we're not treating other people very well because anger is intentionally destructive.
Does it start with fear turning into anger?
So anxiety and fear, in my mind, are the same word, exactly. And so the answer is yes. So anxiety is a signal that there's trouble. So you take action to avoid the trouble. When you can't escape the source causing trouble, your body kicks in a more intense chemical reaction that we call anger. So anger and anxiety are the same threat physiology, but anger is more intense. It has dopamine, so it allows approach behavior to attack, but it's also extremely addictive. So anger is powerful and addictive. Nobody ever wants to give it up, including me. And so to try to fight anxiety and anger just doesn't work. So you have to learn to separate your identity from the survival reactions, which, are, by the way, are a gift, keeping us alive. So you watch your survival reactions do what they do. And then as you separate your identity from that, then you create the identity that you wish over here as a separate skill set. I call it nurturing joy, which is play, spiritual journey, good food, good wine, good friends, which, by the way, are all anti-inflammatory safety actions.
This is beyond interesting, and I haven't heard this kind of thing before, and I think it's super important. And we're going to talk about this in more detail in our second session. So I would like to thank you for being here. This has been Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Dr. David Hanscom, author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain, and Dr. Doug Garland, the Tall Poppy Syndrome author. the joy of cutting others down. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Brian.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.